in the back, inside the front, inside the cover, they engraved all of the names of the people that worked on the Macintosh project. And so if you look back there, you can see Andy Hertzfeld and people you don't recognize. But there's his signature back there, Steve Jobs. So I have Steve Jobs' signature. I bought when I bought his computer in 1984. Yeah, because I went to graduate school in 1984, and I went with a computer. So, at any rate, it's there. I did my master's and my PhD on it. And you go, wow, that's really... keyboard looks terribly clunky and so on. But the operating system was unbelievable. And they had these little floppy disks that held a whole 400K, 0.4 meg, 0.0004 gig. And that was big back then. At any rate, so today's Thursday, October, 6th? And we're going to be continuing on with next chapter, chapter 8 and 9. I've got that all set up to go. And so we'll have a good time. We're talking about carbohydrates. Are there any questions at all? Any questions? Let me go here. Let's see here. Dink and dink. All right. Do we see it yet? Not yet. Let's. Any prayer requests this morning? Anatomy test. And when is that? 2 o'clock today. Oh, my goodness. Yes. You may not notice the sun shining and the birds singing, but you will about 3 or 3:30 whenever the test is over. No, seriously. I can remember being completely involved in that kind of thing. And I can remember. Just how old are you, Dr. Novak? I had it happen to me again yesterday. I went to a store on a weekday afternoon, and I was buying some stuff for lab. And so I get to the checkout counter, and the lady looks at me and says, "A senior discount?" What? What? Yeah, I about walked out, but it's not her fault. I guess I, at any rate, so the only comfort I have is that old people are looking younger and younger. I mean, you know, you can hardly tell somebody the difference between 60 and 70 anymore. And I hope to continue that. All right. Matter of fact, when I hit 60, I'm going to start insisting on a senior discount. That's right. Even on places that don't offer senior discounts, I'm going to start insisting. All right. So, and I have a cold. I'm actually not crying over the fact that someone... although, don't push me. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, we're thankful for every day of life. Life is a miracle in and of itself. Even the smallest bacteria is a miracle, Lord. On small and ornery and dangerous as they may be, it's a miracle. There's no chemistry that says, there's no chemistry compunction, no driving force that would put together a bacterium. Even in its simplest form, the chemistry of it doesn't work. There has to be something more than just natural forces involved. Lord, we're thankful that you are a part of our lives, part of even the bacteria's lives, that we can have breath and awareness, and each day admire this blue sky and admire the human body as we take this horrible, detailed test that's in Latin of all things, Lord. Help us that we can recall those things so that we can become better servants of yours. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Yeah, my theory about why they still have... Is there any necessary reason why all the parts of the body have to be named in Latin? Could they be named in English? Yeah. Why do they put it in Latin? You know, I have a theory why it's all in Latin. Why? It keeps the riffraff out. In other words, that you're a physician or a dentist or a grad student, because you know the Latin names for all of the body. I mean, this is, I'm being a little cynical, but that's my theory. There's no reason why it has to be in Latin. It could easily be in English, but to make it in Latin means you have, that's an achievement. You know, why, you know, there is a reason why religion, I mean, why people in theology have to learn Greek, right? But at any rate, so it's okay. It's all right. It's important. It helps people communicate accurately. And it is what it is. Okay, glycoproteins, ladies and gentlemen. Glycoproteins. And so we are... much of what I'm doing now up in Grand Rapids has to do with glycoproteins. Let me tell you a little story today about glycoproteins that makes it very real, and that is the following. That there are, at the ends of the proteins that are circulating in your body, at the ends of it, facing outward, of these glycoproteins, there are carbohydrates. At the end of those carbohydrate chains are specific kinds of acids, carbohydrates. One type is known as sialic acid. These sialic acids connect to other sialic acids through a variety of bonds. Some called 2,6, which implies what? The number 2 carbon bonding with the number 6. Others are 2,3, the number 2 combining with number 3. You have the flu. There are varieties. The world has different kinds of flu. There are pig flu, or what's also known as swine flu. There's also human flu, and there's also then bird flu. Now, bird flu has many of the characteristics of the epidemic, flu epidemic of 1918, which killed like 30 million people. If you look at the population growth in the United States, the only time that there was a dip in the population from one year to the next was in 1918, when so many people died from the flu, the population of the United States dropped a little bit. It was amazing. And it attacked primarily young people, your age. Their lungs would fill up and they'd literally drown in it. There was no way of knowing, they didn't even, anyway, there were very few tissue samples left, but they found one up in the frozen north that they think is this flu. Be that as it may, the bird flu has an enzyme on its surface that attaches to cells in order for it to get entry into the cells. So does the human flu. The human flu, of course, it targets 2,6 sialic acid bonds to link onto and then get entry into the cell. Bird flu uses 2,3 to get into it. So literally, the only thing that has to happen for bird flu to become human flu is that one protein has a mutation that allows it to bind to 2,3 and not... Yeah, allows it to bind to 2,6, and suddenly you've had a crossover between bird flu and human flu. And that is why they are so concerned when they talk about H1N1 or H5N5 or whatever. It's those kind of variations in terms of the terminology and how they classify these things that switches between bird flu and human flu. And all that is predicated on these surface carbohydrates on proteins that are known as glycoproteins. So I'm going to give you an overview, just a general overview of those glycoproteins. But suffice it to say, they have tremendous importance in your health and in how your body responds to the world and how it recognizes itself and so on. So typically, glycoproteins have a core protein, short chain of branched carbohydrates. There's a variety of them. You won't need to necessarily memorize what this list is. Matter of fact, don't memorize what that list is. I'm not going to ask about what the list is. I am, however, going to look at a broader idea of how they're classified. And that is these glycoproteins, these sugars, attach to proteins through two types of links. The first link is either the sugar is bound to serine or threonine. Now, automatically that means bound to serine or threonine, that means that the side chain is what the carbohydrate is attached to. What's the side chain of threonine and serine? What's its primary functional group there? OH. Both serine and threonine have an OH side chain, or at least OH on the side chain. And those complicated sugars come from precursor sugars. They're built up from UDP glucose, galactose, N-acetylglucosamine, etc. And they create these complicated branch proteins. So you can either attach it through a serine or threonine. That's one classification. All right. Then there's another classification through the amide nitrogen of asparagine. So what I want you to do here is, and I think I talk about this later, but let's highlight it right now, that where it says attachment of sugar to serine or threonine, I want you to add the term O-linked, capital O-linked, O-linked. And down here where it says asparagine, and of asparagine, I want you to type in N-linked, N-linked, capital N-linked. Those are the two primary classifications of glycoproteins. It turns out that there's a functional difference between the two and how they are synthesized. All right, the N-linked glycoproteins, the carbohydrate chains initially synthesized on adalacyl phosphate. That adalacyl phosphate is a fatty alcohol that's embedded in the membranes. It's a fatty alcohol that's embedded in the membrane. It's then transferred to the protein. Glycoproteins exist in mucus, blood, compartments of the cell, extracellular matrix. Glycoproteins are all over. There seems to be, anyway, they're embedded in the cell membrane with the carbohydrate extending toward the extracellular space. Now, I want you to circle that last idea right here. That last idea is an important idea about determining what is inside a cell and what's outside a cell. There is almost an 100% uniformity, and notice my little weasel words when I say almost 100%. Well, that's the necessity of biochemistry. It's never say never, always never say always. For every rule, I'm sure I can find an exception to it. But the 99.99% of the time, the carbohydrate, if it's on a membrane-bound protein, the carbohydrate is pointed toward the exterior, or eventually pointed toward the exterior. Now, this is, there are, therefore I mentioned, I talked about, okay, here we go. All right, so on this particular overhead, the first blank is called O-linked glycoproteins. O-linked glycoproteins, the synthesis of these are not shown here. Then the next blank is capital RER. Next blank after that is serine or threonine. This is overhead number 13, by the way. Next blank after that is complexity. N-linked glycoproteins is the next blank or series of blanks. Again, with a capital RER is the next blank. Next blank after that is dolichol, D-O-L-I-C-H-O-L, dolichol, pyrophosphate. And the final blank is Golgi. All right. So, very straightforward. So the first part of this overhead talks about a little bit, I mean just a glancing low, about how the carbohydrates of O-linked glycoproteins are formed. The protein is synthesized in rough ER and extruded in the rough ER lumen. Now, what is the lumen of the rough ER? It's the inside, right, exactly. It's the inside. And as soon as that happens, at the specific location that there's going to be an O-linked carbohydrate started, N-acetylgalactosamine, which is the base unit for that oligosaccharide, adds either serine or threonine, depending on the specificity of the enzyme and the folding of the protein. then a whole series of complex glycosyl transferases in the rough ER, in the ER Golgi apparatus, increase the complexity of that O-linked carbohydrate chain. We could spend an entire semester dealing with the complex carbohydrate synthesis of O-linked and N-linked carbohydrates and their ultimate fate. It's tremendously complex, not nearly as clearly defined. Its synthesis is not nearly as clearly defined as it is with DNA and RNA and protein. It's been a terribly complex process to find these glycosyl transferases, which are crucially important to adding these carbohydrates to the proteins, are notoriously unstable. You get them out of the cell, try to study them, boom, they unfold and they're gone, they lose their activity. So it's been a very tough thing to try to find any kind of consistency in the behavior of these things. They've become pretty good at determining the actual carbohydrate structure of the glycoprotein, but not much after that. That not how it all gets synthesized. Now, N-linked glycoproteins is the second part of the this chapter, of this slide number 13. That has an interesting different kind of synthesis. What happens here is the protein and the complex carbohydrate are synthesized separately and then brought together after the synthesis of the complex carbohydrate. So the N-linked glycoproteins begin with the protein being synthesized in the rough ER with processing in the Golgi. And that's demonstrated up here in this diagram. You do not see a diagram like this in your book. There's another one sort of similar to it, but it's not quite like this. So the protein synthesis is initiated. The carbohydrate, I mean, here's the rough, here's a the ribosome, I mean, the messenger RNA, pardon me. It's going through these ribosomes. They insert the growing polypeptide chain in through a pore here into the lumen of their endoplasmic reticulum. And while that's occurring, there is a dolichyl base, dolichyl pyrophosphate, that's being synthesized bound to that dolichyl pyrophosphate. So this branched chain oligosaccharide and these squares and circles and triangles and stuff have a specific kind of carbohydrate that they are associated with, a MAP. So this is synthesized, and in step three, the oligosaccharide is transferred in toto from the dolichyl to the asparagine residue. And there's the beginning of that N-linked glycoprotein. Immediately following that transfer of that fairly complex oligosaccharide, it gets trimmed by a variety of glycosyl transferases. Then this protein eventually gets transferred to the Golgi apparatus, where a lot of other trimming and other additional glycosyl transferases act on that chain, and you get a complex glycoprotein that has a bewildering, and I mean bewildering, variety of N groups on that complex carbohydrate. All that in total makes a glycoprotein. The key, not the key, but one of the things that's going on currently in modern cancer biology, cancer biochemistry, is that they're beginning to realize that as they're looking for markers for cancer, specifically like me, I'm trying to find markers for pancreatic cancer. So Steve Jobs' death has an especial meaning to me because I kind of grew up with him and because I'm working on pancreatic cancer. And that's what he died of, essentially. And so one of the reasons why pancreatic cancer is almost invariably fatal is that there's no early detection of it. That the pancreas has such excess capacity that once a tumor grows, you don't know that it's growing by any kind of physiological response. You don't feel bad, even though there's a tumor growing in that thing, because it's still producing insulin appropriately and stuff. And the first time people discover they have pancreatic cancer is when they start having yellow eyes or they're having digestive problems or something. And the bile is not being produced appropriately, and you start poking around, discover there's a tumor growing in your pancreas. And by that time, based on the blood flow from the pancreas, it is closely associated with the liver, and invariably there's metastases in the liver. And so you end up having this enveloped pancreatic cancer that has metastasized in the liver, many times also, for example, bone and so on. By the time they discover it, it's too late. Then the another thing is that tumors of the digestive tract have a tendency to release compounds, proteins of a complex nature that we haven't been able to discover yet, and initiate a process called cachexia, which is wasting. Did you see pictures of Steve Jobs near the end of his life? Okay. He was skin and bones. He was all skin and bones. You don't find that necessarily with breast cancer, but you do find that with cancers of the digestive tract. They are uniquely, they have a unique impact on metabolism of energy products. So here he was. You can see this. Notice his face. Notice his face. Notice the flesh on his face. That's then. And let's see if I can get back here. This was his last public appearance, or near that. I mean, you look at that, and you can see the distinctive kind of skin and bones appearance. He's got no adipose tissue under his skin. His skin, his wrists, if you look there, you can see the bone, especially there. I'm sorry. The bone. And so he's dying. He's dying, slowly dying, because the cancer is slowly overwhelming some of his tissues, but also because of these factors released by released by tumors involved in the digestive tract, their signaling gets whacked. And either it's a nerve thing or a protein thing or both, or it could be even a normal protein that has different carbohydrates on its surface that create different signaling. The body is somehow told to begin wasting. And he's losing muscle tissue, and he's losing fat tissue. Okay. Pray that you die some other way, honestly. I don't know. Here he was in a younger time, notice. And let's see where else. I want you to come by sometime this afternoon and drop by the chemistry department. I've got the original Mac World that has this picture on it. I bought it off the stand 29 years ago. I've never owned any other computer but a Macintosh. And so Steve Jobs had a lifestyle I wouldn't necessarily agree with. He was also extremely volatile in terms of his character. He didn't make many enemies, but he really annoyed people a lot. And so, you know, this creative genius, by no means was he even close to being perfect. But he had a vision. Man, he had a vision unlike any other. All right, so anyway, so you have this complex carbohydrate which has important roles to play in health and wellness, and it's finally processed in the Golgi apparatus. Now, typically, many of these things end up on the surface. What? Yes. So if you follow the... If you follow what happens, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know. If this is the nucleus, there's a rough ER, there's the Golgi apparatus. secretory vesicles bleb and fuse with the membrane, you find that these proteins, and I'm going to have a hard time drawing this, these proteins have the carbohydrate in the interior lumen of that. But when they fuse with the surface, what was the interior
then of that becomes the exterior. And again, you find that on with the plasma membrane here, you find that proteins that penetrate the plasma membrane, that's where you find the carbohydrate chain is on the exterior of the protein, not on the interior toward the cell. And you can pretty much diagnose and label a protein, and if it finds a carbohydrate on it, you're looking at the exterior of the cell. Are there diseases that come with this? Absolutely. Metabolism of these carbohydrates produces a lot of diseases. And let's see here. There's a disease called an eye cell disease. Eye cell disease. So there are like five blanks here. And you got mannose is the first blank. Next blank is absent. Next blank is lysosome. The last blank is mistargeting of proteins, not abscess or excess. So we're talking about proteins that accumulate because they've been mistargeted. Let's take a look at this eye cell disease. It has to do with N-linked glycoproteins. Now, what did I say? Now, how many different kinds of links are there? Two. And the first one was, I talked about, is O. And the next one was N. And this is a disease of N-linked oligosaccharide. So here you've got this ER, a protein, pre-lysosomal protein. There's the asparagine, so you know automatically it's N-linked. And there's a mannose that plays a crucial role. There is the eye cell disease is caused by the deficiency of ability to phosphorylate that mannose. Under normal circumstances, the mannose gets phosphorylated, and that targets it for a particular fate in the cell. Characterized, so if you are missing that phosphorylated, that enzyme that does that phosphorylation, you end up having, and it's a genetic disease, skeletal abnormalities, restricted joint, coarse facial features, severe psychomotor impairment. Death usually occurs by 8 years of age. So genetically, if you have that eye cell disease, you're doomed. That, as far as I know, I don't think there's any metabolism or there's no, you know, treatment for it. There's no diet that helps or helps it or whatever. Under normal circumstances, that phosphorylated mannose is then targeted for the trans-Golgi apparatus. There's a mannose 6-phosphate receptor on the trans-Golgi apparatus that targets this to a transport vesicle that says, go to the lysosome. Go to the lysosome. So that phosphorylated mannose gets attached there, gets released in this transport vesicle, the phosphate comes off, and then this enzyme or protein is bound for the lysosome. Without that there, this pre-lysosomal enzyme in the ER begins to build up and causes severe problems and death. All right. High concentrations of hyalytic enzymes show up in the plasma. Unhydrolyzed substrates accumulate in the lysosome. This is a disease of mistargeting proteins, not abscess or excess. Notice the symptoms. So this you need to know pretty well. I'm liable to ask you a question about this. I will not ask you to memorize that diagram, nor will I ask you to memorize this diagram. Again, this is another way that they demonstrate this process. This is related to the previous slide, slide number 13. This is a detail. This shows the specific kinds of carbohydrates that are in that complex carbohydrate. This is what's bound initially, transferred from the dolichyl phosphate and attached to that asparagine of the polypeptide. It gets trimmed, again. Then the Golgi apparatus, it gets further trimmed and additional things to yield a variety, like I said, an enormous variety of N-linked glycoproteins. That's it for chapter 8, ladies and gentlemen. Next chapter is chapter 9. All right. And we're going to go straight on. Lipids and biological membranes. How many of us like lipids? Raise your hand if you like a lipid. Sure. Is there anybody that... Now, I mean, there is nothing like having a chocolate chip cookie that's made out of either butter or butter-flavored shortening. Okay? Some of the worst tasting food for many years was diet food that had little or no fat in it.
Okay, it was almost inedible. Because fat really helps us taste. It provides that satiation that tells us we're full. And we have a primordial need to have a full gut. Okay? We're driven to eat, not surprisingly. All right. So what we're going to be looking at in today is lipids and biological membranes. We're going to be looking for structures and names of fatty acids, names of fats, glycerol, phospholipids, sphingolipids, lipids, steroids, prostaglandins, membrane structures, fluidity, and cholesterol. And then just as a little lark here, I threw in a little couple little sayings here. Bachelors know more about women than married do. Married men, if they didn't, they'd be married too. I'm not sure. Hey, do you know, you guys know anything about H.L. Mencken? He was a bit of a curmudgeon. In other words, he was kind of a cynic and sarcastic person. And then you have the corresponding, a bachelor never quite gets over the idea that he's a thing of beauty and a boy forever. That's right. Okay. Have I told you my one joke about marriage? Oh, yes, I have. Sure, I haven't yet. It's nearly halfway through the semester. My wife and I have a perfect understanding about our relationship. Yeah, I've said that before. Yeah. What's the rest of it? Men, you need to remember this. Okay. My wife and I have a perfect understanding of our relationship. I don't try to run her life, and I don't try to run mine. You laugh, but you wait. Okay. Men, the king of the universe at work, they come home. Guess what? Yes, dear. And is it that way appropriately? Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. You know, we hear about in Saudi Arabia about how women have no rights, and that's true. They virtually have no rights. They can't drive. They can't be out seen in public with a relative, with a man that's not a relative. But once inside the house, those women rule the roost. That man doesn't do a thing without her saying so. So I don't know about the society on the exterior, but in the interior, the women rule the women really rule the country. All right. So we need to go ahead. Now, I like fats. I eat them. I have extra. I store them for winter. Okay? Trying to get rid of them. I suppose that's a little foolish. All right? As you get older, should you gain weight? Should you gain a lot of weight? No. Should you gain a little weight? Yes. There are men and women who are thin as rails when they're 80 years old. Okay? And I suppose they look all right. But if they get sick and go in the hospital, guess what they don't have? Any reserves. So my recommendation is to you that as you get a little older, fine, gain a little weight. It's okay. All right? As long as you gain a little weight, you have regular exercise and sleep and lots of social interaction, you're fine. Don't let food Nazis tell you that by being 1 pound overweight, you're going to kill yourself. It's bogus. Lipids. How do you define lipids? Lipids literally are what you see here. Let's see if I can go through this. Boy. Oh, too far. Too far, too far, too far, too far. Again, too far. I'm sorry. All right, let me go slower this time. Okay, the first blank is hydrocarbon. Next blank is 16C and 18C. Next two blanks after that are bent and straight. Next two blanks after that are solid and liquid. Next blank after that is reduced and hydration. Last blank after that is 21% and 26%. 21% and 26%. All right, so you got nonpolar, hydrocarbon, 16C, 18C, bent, straight, solid, liquid, reduced, hydration, 21%, 26%. So, if you take a biological material and you put it in diethyl ether and you squish it, you take a piece of fresh meat, ground hamburger, all right, and you just go in that diethyl ether. Everything that dissolves in that diethyl ether, everything that dissolves in that diethyl ether is by definition a what? Lipid.
Lipid. So lipids lipid is a very broad stroke because that's a very simple extraction process. So there's cholesterol and fat and prostaglandins. I mean, you name it, that's primarily hydrocarbon, and it's in that lipid. So it's in that diethyl ether. That's what a lipid is. So there's a whole bunch of things. The first set we're going to look at are known as fatty acids. Carboxylic acids with long chain hydrocarbon groups. You got stearic acid, oleic acid, linoleic acid, alpha-linolenic acid, for example. Most common are 16 carbons and 18 carbons. But typical, you have 10 carbons to 20 carbons with even number of carbons. Why even number of carbons? Why even number of carbons? Why even number of carbons? La, I have assorted chalk. I don't really want assorted chalk. But they left me no choice. Pardon me. There's no other chalk here. And I'm not going to use. I hate colored chalk. Do you remember the first metabolism quiz we had? It was entitled what? Metabolism overview, wasn't it? Yeah, pardon me. My nose is dripping, and I apologize for that. Metabolism overview. So let's quickly run through this. What happened to it? We started out with glucose. Is that correct? Glucose. Then it went to what? Glucose 6-phosphate. You guys do remember, you see. And then it went through glycolysis, and it ended up in what? What do you end glycolysis with? Pyruvate. Thank you very much. Oh, you know, you're just asleep. Pyruvate. What were the fates of pyruvate? You remember? It went on to make something else. Acetyl-CoA. Now, do you remember this? This acetyl-CoA had a couple of fates. Was one of the fates fatty acids? Or no? Did I put that in there? I don't remember if I did or not. I think so. The reason why, at least in mammals, why fatty acids are two carbons long, is because the building block is acetyl-CoA. And how many carbons are there in acetyl-CoA? Two. Where do you find odd-chain fatty acids? Plant material. Very little, if any, odd-chain fatty acids in mammals or animals that you might eat. So all this is coming, any odd chain are coming from plant material. All right, so found as esters, we'll talk about later. Saturated, unsaturated. Saturated means what? Was it? Saturated means what? Maximum number of hydrogens. That means there's no what? No double bonds. So then we have unsaturated. What if you have more than one unsaturated bond? What's that called? Polyunsaturated. There you go. You got the cis and you got the bent. I mean, you got the cis, which is bent, and you got trans, which is straight. Trans. What are advertisers railing against now? What do they have at the top of their boxes? 0 grams of what? Trans fatty acids. Why is that? Well, it appears that the trans fatty acids comes from the artificial hydrogenation of oils to make it into fats. So the trans fats primarily, but not exclusively, come from man's addition of hydrogen to polyunsaturated fatty acids. Seldom branched, okay? Esters are typically linked to glycerol, three of them, which means glycerol has three hydroxy, which means you get three esters out of it. So you get these triacylglycerols, also known as triglycerides. That means the same thing. What's the distinguishing feature between fats and oils? What? Fats are gross. Yes? Yeah, this is just very simple. Fats are lipids that are solid at room temperature, And oils are liquid room temperature. That's it. That's the only difference between a fat and oil. It's fundamentally the same thing. They'll explain to you a little bit what the chemical structure is that causes that minor difference, but essentially a fat and an oil are the same thing. Now then, why then, you know, when you with my little love handles I have back here, whatever you want to call them, that guys get right in this area, why, it's actually fairly loose, isn't it? Right? Fairly loose. And so why don't I call that oil? Because I'm not at what? I'm not at room temperature. What happens when I become room temperature? What happens to this? Does it stay loose? It stiffens up and becomes a what? A solid room temperature. So that's why it's fat right here. That's why I call it fat and not oil. Because at room temperature, when I reach room temperature, that's going to be all solid. Yum. At any rate, so why don't cannibals like to eat clowns? Because they taste funny. Thank you very much. And part of it is because they got this fat with them. At any rate, not components of membranes. So fats and oils are not components of membranes. Energy storage, heat insulation. Yay! Okay? Yay! Is it an accident that it's called whale blubber? That whales have lots and lots of fat on them. Is that an accident? No. It's heat insulation. All right. Fat contains 6 times the energy per unit mass than carbohydrate. If I changed all the fat in my body into carbohydrate, I would weigh the same energy? The same energy? Let's see here. On a normal guy, if the energy storage changed from fat into carbohydrate, that means glycogen, he'd weigh about 40 pounds more. Because the glycogen is a less energy dense, but also has to have water to solvate it. So you have both the glycogen and the water to hold carbohydrate as an energy storage. Whereas fats exclude water and are much higher energy density, so you can get more energy stored as fat than you can as carbohydrate. The vast majority of times when people begin weight loss and we have rapid weight loss, the first couple weeks or whatever, they lose 6-7 pounds. Invariably, what they're doing is they're eliminating the excess carbohydrate in their muscle tissue and so on, and with that, they lose the excess water that has to be there to solvate that carbohydrate. And so they quickly lose 5 or 6 pounds, but it's all carbohydrate and water. The real fat that's there hasn't been touched yet. And then that's when, after the first couple weeks, that's when the hard work happens. Okay, so more reduced, less water of hydration, 21% body fat for men, 26% for women. Do you ever want it to be the same? Yes? Yeah, I mean, from a physiological point of view, do you ever want it to be the same? No. No. Why? Can a woman be too thin to bear children? Yes. You can be so thin that your lipid metabolism is so messed up that you cannot bear children. Okay. Now that's pretty thin, but also you want fat stores because you have to feed the baby, and that's fine, all right? Also, fat provides secondary sexual characteristics between men and women, okay? So, God put into a man's mind that a woman with curves looks mighty fine, and that's just fine, okay? All right? God put that in us. And you like it when a man doesn't have fat because it means that, well, there's a variety of things that it means, but it probably means mostly he's under control. And he's young and virile. Unlike me, okay? I'm a little frumpy, a little doughboy. I've got no hair. I'm not a good partner for somebody who's 20 years old. Unless, of course, I'm worth $100 million, but that's a different societal issue altogether. Okay. Now, Let's take a look at some of these. Now, what I'm going to ask you to do is, there's some coding here we need to know, and we're going to go through this pretty quickly. This table is known as saturated fatty acids, which contain what? Actually, they contain nothing but single bonds. Unsaturated can contain at least one. In this case, all double bonds are cis. Now, oddly enough, these cis double bonds put a kink in the structure. Trans do not put a kink. So let's take a look here. You got, what do you think the 16 and 0 means? 16 means what? And what does 0 mean? No double bonds. Palmitic acid. So put a little check mark behind. Let's do a check mark. Do a check mark next to lauric acid, next to palmitic acid, next to stearic acid. That's it. Those three. 12, 16, and 18. Lauric acid. All right. When you now wash your hair, read the shampoo bottle, and then probably the second or third ingredient is sodium lauryl sulfate. That lauryl means now you're dealing with fatty acid that has how many carbons with it? 12. And how many double bonds? None. Okay, now, unsaturated fatty acids. Let's take a look at the 18s. These are kind of entertaining. The 18, 0, is what? Stearic acid, meaning cal. All right, and then you got 18-1, 18-2, 18-3. The 18-1 is oleic acid. 18-2 is linoleic acid. And 18-3 is linolenic acid. And there's a couple different positions there. So you've got four fatty acids that have 18 carbons. The first one that has no double bonds is called what? Stearic. What's its actual scientific name? Octadecanoic. Now, it seems a little awkward, and I'm going to need to quit. It sounds like, well, doesn't that mean eight tens? Octadecanoic, isn't that eight tens? No, it actually means 8 and 10, which is then what? 18. So that's why 12 is known as dodecanoic. Two. Do. It's a variation of two. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you guys tomorrow. I will be here tomorrow morning. We're going to have a little quiz. Is that right? Thank you very much.
Time.